Hello, everyone, and welcome to Police Off the Cuff, Real Crime Stories. I'm your host, retired NYPD Sergeant Bill Cannon, a 27-year veteran of the NYPD. We're covering a story tonight that actually is about, you know, it's about a week old, but we all watched in horror as we saw images, and there's one up on the screen, of a Singapore-flagged ship named the Dali after Salvador Dali, the artist, crashed into the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore. And I think that was what was the most horrifying was the fact that the entire bridge just crumbled, just came down. And we'll get into this. There's many heroes in this story, and many more lives could have been lost than were, if not for the bravery of some police officers that did their job and closed the bridge up as this horrific, but prior to this horrific accident, this impending collision. And tonight we're going to have a special guest with us also. He's been on the show before, a retired FBI agent and scuba expert. He was in charge of the FBI scuba team when he was an FBI agent. You've seen him on all different channels, CNN, ABC, CBS, Fox. I call him what we all refer to as a talking head. And he's one of the best at it. And his name is Bobby Chacon, and I'm going to introduce him in a little bit. But first, guys, hold on to your hats. Get ready. You're about to enter true crime from a police perspective. You're about to enter the off-the-cuff zone, the police off the cuff zone.
There has to be some common sense.
Yes, sir. They have the car stopped in Tampa Ranch by Friday.
We still don't know who pulled the trigger.
You know, according to the New York Times, the 5 minutes that brought down the Francis Scott Key Bridge, when a massive cargo ship lost power in Baltimore, crews scrambled to control the ship and to evacuate the bridge lying ahead, but it was too late. Hold all traffic on the Key Bridge. The terse command from an officer in Baltimore's busy commercial shipping port was one of the first warnings of a disaster that experts now predict will transform shipping on the eastern seaboard and change how ships and bridges function around the world. But after the cargo ship Dali lost power early Tuesday, there were precious few moments to act. In those minutes, many people from the ship's crew who sent out a Mayday signal to the Transportation Authority police officers who stopped traffic heading onto the Francis Scott Key Bridge, they did what they could to avert catastrophe, most likely saving many lives. And yet, no matter what anyone did, several factors made catastrophe all but inevitable. When a ship of this size loses engine power, there's little to be done to correct its course, even dropping an anchor down. And the Key Bridge was particularly vulnerable. As long ago as 1980, engineers had warned that the bridge, because of its design, would never be able to survive a direct hit from a container ship. The collision and subsequent collapse of the bridge swallowed up 7 road workers and an inspector who could not be alerted and pulled off the bridge in time. 2 were pulled alive out of the water, but 4 others are still missing and presumed dead. 2 bodies were retrieved on Wednesday. Also caught up in the disaster were the ship's 21 crew members, all from India, who had prepared for a long journey to Sri Lanka on the Dali. So these are all, that's sort of the giving you the background to this. And an expert on things of the maritime nature, especially the dives for this, the dangerous, dangerous dives, are FBI agent Bobby Chacon. Welcome to the show. Bobby, welcome to the show.
Good to see you, boss. Thanks for having me back.
great to see you. I mean, I can't compete with all these talking head stations you're on. You do an unbelievable job, and you seem like the go-to guy. No, Bobby, let's get right into this. And one of the things a layman like me or people that are watching this, what is so scary is when you watch that bridge just crumble. It looked like a toy. And it was like
in seconds, like so quickly and so completely from end to end, just how quick it really even got me about how quick that came down.
And Bobby, you know what really scared me is that how many more bridges across the USA are built exactly in that fashion?
Yeah. Well, you know, I took my dive team to Minneapolis in 2007 when the I-35 bridge collapsed, if you remember that one. So we were on scene within 48 hours of that bridge collapse. We lost 13 people in that bridge collapse. And so I know very well about bridge collapses. And that was the last major one we've had. And I, like I said, my dive team was on site within 48 hours. And the difference with this one was it happened at 2 a.m., whereas the I-35 bridge in Minneapolis collapsed at rush hour in the daytime. But there were some similarities. There was construction going on the bridge in Minneapolis. And that somewhat contributed to the weight bearing that broke that bridge and stuff. Another difference is that bridge collapsed without warning. And as you pointed out in the lead up on this story just now, how many lives may have been saved by those quick thinking officers who got on either end of that bridge and stopped traffic.
Bobby, can you imagine being with your family and driving across one of these bridges? And even now, the paranoia of thinking that something like this could happen. I remember years ago, I drove the Chesapeake Bay Bridge at night like a fool, but my kids were young and I wanted my wife and everyone to sleep and leave me alone. So I drove and I was like, wow, this is pretty damn scary. I think that bridge was like 17 miles long. Mm-hmm. And it's a bridge, and then it's sunken in some areas. And I was like, I don't know. I don't think I want to do this again.
You know? Yeah, can you imagine the people that travel that key bridge, you know, every day? You know, if that ship would have hit at rush hour, a loss of life, that could have happened. I mean, and it just, but for a couple of hours, I mean, 2 a.m. is not that far off from, say, 6 or 7 a.m. when morning rush hour would have been on that bridge. Can you imagine the loss of life that would have happened then?
Unbelievable. I'm going to play this a short video of the actual ship hitting the bridge.
Baltimore, Maryland. A portion of the Francis Scott Key Bridge has collapsed. You see what happened down into the harbor. That large boat collided with the bridge around 1:30 this morning. That just sent the span rippling down into those freezing waters below. Authorities are trying to rescue at least 7 people who were doing overnight work on the bridge. They're believed to have been tossed into the waves. Fire crews say several vehicles hit the water, including one the size of a tractor trailer, hoping people were able to get out of their vehicles when they got into the water. Divers have been dispatched into the water for what is now being called a dire mass casualty incident. Just, I have chills.
Yeah.
Thinking about the people who were in those vehicles and the workers.
And now the rescue that's underway.
And so we're going to think good thoughts and send prayers and bring you updates as soon as they come in.
Absolutely scary. You know, Bobby, you're a diver and I can't even imagine going into that water in the daytime. Nevertheless, at night when it's freezing, the visibility is nothing. I mean, isn't that one of the scariest possible dives you can do?
Yeah, and it really shouldn't be attempted by people on scuba. It should be hard hat diving helmets that we have, surface applied air systems. It really needs almost a commercial, a military salvage type of operation. If you shouldn't put anybody in there that's not tethered to the surface and that doesn't have a large amount of breathing air, because there are trap hazards, there are fall hazards. I mean, think about how strong water is. It held up that big ship, right? Water moves things around. So those cars, those big pieces of concrete, the water can move them around like they're a rag doll. And so if you're a diver, you could get caught in there, and water's always moving things. And it's a very, very treacherous. And, you know, in our line of work, when I did 19 years, I had the dive team, you know, there was a kind of a mantra that you don't get a diver killed trying to retrieve another dead body, you know? And so you really have to kind of be careful about putting divers in the water in this type of situation.
So you'll go into the water for as a life-saving technique, you know, if there's a chance someone's alive, but for recovery, there's no rush. There was absolutely, you said it so correctly, there's no rush to retrieve a dead body because you could join the dead body as being dead because it's that dangerous.
And it's happened before. Rescue teams have lost divers trying to be a little bit too aggressive in going after a body that's already dead and they know it, the person's already dead. So that's a cardinal sin of search and recovery is getting someone hurt because either you went too fast or you put somebody in a situation that they're not trained or equipped for. And that's like I said, that's the cardinal sin of doing that because there's no rush. You know, after what that water I think was 48 degrees. By sunup the next day, there was no rescuing anybody in that water. So you know, you have to make that call. And I know that the fire departments a lot of times will jump into water like that, and that's okay. But boy, you better be really certain there's somebody to save, or else you're putting your divers at very, very unnecessary risk.
And you better be pretty damn good at what you do.
And you better be used to diving in this type of situation, in this type of environment. You know, now, thankfully, now there'll be, you know, the Navy sent some salvage divers up. And, you know, when we went to Minneapolis, we had our big hard hat diving helmets on, our surface supplied air systems. We actually worked in support of the Navy salvage divers that were there. They arrived a couple of days after us. And so that's who arrived at the Key Bridge as well. And now, hopefully, they'll be removed and you'll have just commercial salvage divers working for insurance companies, most likely. Even after you showed that to me again, and I've seen it already, it still sent me chills thinking, what if that was rush hour? Because when I look at that, it almost looked to me like one of those controlled demolitions of a building where you purposely bring the whole thing down completely. Yeah. That bridge, so complete, there was nothing left. It would just completely disappear. I would have never guessed. You know, you would have thought maybe sections would have stayed standing or leaning, that the whole thing went down so completely. And if it was rush hour, just a couple of hours later into the morning rush hour, there would have been this. It would have been a catastrophe. I can't even remember the last time, you know, we had a catastrophe that would have been, you know, hundreds, if not more, deaths at the Key Bridge on rush hour.
You know, Bobby, one of the things you see this ship here, and that the bridge is on the front part of this ship, and they, I think I saw some video of them with acetylene torches cutting it, trying to cut it, but they have to be so careful because it has to be removed in sections, and if it you know, just like a rubber band snaps, it can be extremely, extremely dangerous and kill lots of people. So I would imagine they must secure part of it with a crane as they cut the other part and lower it slowly.
That's right. And the divers will be dealing with the same thing. They'll be cutting things underwater. And so when you have these twisted girders and twisted steel I-beams, when they're twisted like that, they're under tension. And when you cut, you're going to relieve some of that tension and there's going to be a spring effect. And so the divers have to be really careful when they're cutting underneath. So what you do is you take a lot of sonar imaging. Sonars will be going back and forth. You put ROVs in the water, remote operated vehicles, those little kind of robots that have video and sonar on them to watch the divers as they're doing their work. The engineers review the underwater sonar imaging and say, okay, we're going to cut this section first and we're going to tie it off. And then the divers are going to, you know, and you could even do it where, you know, they cut it 95% of the way, they rig it, the divers get way out of the way and maybe up top, and then they, you know, the crane can yank it and bust that last 5% of it maybe. So you try to do stuff like that to keep the divers away, because the minute you take a chunk out, other stuff is going to move around on you, especially underwater. Other stuff is going to fall and settle and the water is going to push things around. So you never know how things are going to react or respond. So it's really treacherous when the divers are down there cutting pieces of this. They have to take it piece by piece, small piece by small piece. And it's a very labor intensive and time consuming effort.
You know what this reminds me of, Bobby? It reminds me of the steel at the World Trade Center, but times 10. It's much worse in the water. But it was the same issues. They were like we have to know which pieces to move first, or it'll all shift and it could kill people.
Right, exactly.
And they had engineers trying to figure that out. And of course, to me, and nothing against anyone in law enforcement or the fire department, anything, some of the biggest heroes in 9/11 were the steelworkers.
Sure.
Unheralded heroes.
Yeah.
They did absolutely an unbelievable job. And, you know, I can imagine that probably the steelworkers are enlisted here also.
Yep. The steelworkers will be doing all the stuff topside. Many, many engineers, many divers, you know, cutting underwater, and many barge personnel, crane operators. Yeah, it's going to take a very concerted effort to, you know, first of all, to get all of that bridge off the bottom is going to take a long time. And then, you know, then becomes the effort of rebuilding it. And how that goes about is that's a monumental task now, because you're talking about not just replacing the bridge that was there, but replacing it in a way that it doesn't have the same weaknesses that this bridge had.
Well, there are so many issues coming in. And right away, I think today they're trying to open up two lanes of the river. And I believe one of them had a 10-foot draft and the other a 14-foot draft. And so just certain size ships can go through that. But it would seem like, hey, wait, just take it easy. You know, but money talks and bullshit walks, as you know. And that may be too soon to do that. But the
those are very small drafts for the type of freighters that used to, you know, would go through there. That ship that hit the bridge, that's probably got a 40, 48 foot, you know. There are ships I remember when I worked in New York, the Hudson, you know, it's about 50 feet pretty consistently, the basin. And some of those ships were drafting 48 feet. They had about 2 feet of clearance on the bottom. I think I heard that the Baltimore port there is like the number one port for new cars or cars, you know, freight coming in there, at least on the East Coast. And, you know, we're going to see the price of new cars go up for the next 2 or 3 years, you know, because then they can't get the cars in this way. They got to bring them in another way. I'm sure there's going to be obviously a lot of litigation. As far as like on the criminal side, there's still, you know, it's an accident, right? We all know it's an accident. However, you know, there are cases, and obviously we've watched this for about 18 months now, cases where accidents, if they're such a result of negligence, gross negligence, we call it, that, you know, there could be some criminal liability, criminally negligent homicide. So you don't know how they're going to look at this. I'm sure they're investigating that. You know, my first question is, some of these more modern ships anyway, they have independently powered backup systems that give you they can't run the whole ship, but they can run some basic functions of the ship, like steering and propulsion. And so why wasn't the ship outfitted with a separately powered, you know, e-power or generator power that's separate from the main power supply to the ship that could give them a little bit of steering, a little bit of propulsion? You know, my question would be, why aren't those ships outfitted with something like that? So if the entire ship loses power, you have a little bit of emergency power left on an independent circuit that can power you at least to get you to, you know, wherever, small, you know, even battery backup is, you know, is probably not, there's probably not big enough batteries to power that ship, but you should have some kind of independent emergency backup system that could use basic steering and propulsion functions. And you know, that might be something, you know, not only to build the bridges differently, but build the ships a little differently, because accidents happen all the time. Ships lose power, but they don't always go drifting into a bridge like this. So I'm sure the ship company is going to be under some examination. The crew is going to be, their actions are going to be, you know, under examination. You know, it's unfortunate, but you have to do that. You have to do an honest hot wash of an incident like this so that you can make different rules and regulations going forward so this doesn't happen again.
Well, they have the NTSB, National Transportation Safety Board, will investigate this. I'm sure there's all kinds of the Coast Guard, other maritime investigators will get involved in this. What I was amazed at, when a ship that size comes into a harbor, there has to be a pilot, what's known as a pilot, go on the ship. So however he gets on the ship, you see the pull up those little doors on the side and they have to time it to get on right. Or, you know, I don't know exactly, but this had a pilot who had 10 years experience in the Baltimore Harbor and a an assistant who wasn't experienced, who was more or less an apprentice, who was learning. But it seemed like the pilot did everything right. He put out the Mayday. He threw the had them throw the anchor out. He had them do all the proper things, but there was no power. So there was nothing really he could do. But yet, I wonder if in his career, this will taint his career, because he happened to be the pilot that day when this horrific accident occurred.
Yeah, you know, I hope not, because I agree with you. I think he did everything right, and I think that Mayday call probably saved lives and stuff. And so I think he did everything right. I think the further examination has to be on the ship itself and the maintenance records of the ship, things like that. Why did this happen to begin with? But you're right. I mean, anybody that's ever operated, a jet ski or a watercraft, you know, it's very different than a car or a motorcycle. On land, when you lay off the throttle, the vessel just stops, right? The motorcycle stops, the car stops when you take your foot off the gas, right? It's not that way in the water. When you're moving and you're proposing, you can stop all your power. The ship or the watercraft still exists. In fact, if you've ever been, you know, in a tight spot with a jet ski, you know that your instinct is to take off the throttle, slow down. But really, you need to give it power so that you can steer, right? Steering right. comes with propulsion on the water. And so it's a little different. It's almost counterintuitive. But you know, that's what you need to think about and stuff. And so, like, you know, it's really tough when you're dead in the water. That big ship is just drifting and you have no power to stop it, because the way you stop in the water is reverse propulsion.
Right.
Propulsion, right? You go in reverse and you stop it. That's the only way. Because if taking your foot off the gas, so to speak, is not going to do it on the water, because that forward momentum is going to just keep carrying you.
There's no brakes or brake pads on the
there's no brakes like that. Your only brake is to go in reverse.
One thing I forgot to mention, there were two tugboats, and he had released the tugboats, but then when they lost propulsion or power, he called them back, but I think it was too late.
It was too late. You know? Yeah, it was too late, I think. Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah, every harbor has a harbor pilot. They're a big union, actually. They're pretty powerful. And they go out on small ships. I don't know if people notice, but every, you know, before you come into a port, that harbor pilot, who's very familiar with that water, that's why they're there. They're supposed to know that harbor very well. And there's a number of them, because they're on ships constantly. A small boat brings them out to the big freighters. They get on board and they pilot this ship in from outside into the dock. And they're very good at what they do. They know their local waters. They know the drafts. They know the sandbars. They know the currents, the winds. And I'm sure he did a tremendous job on this one. And like you said, I think he probably saved lives by thinking very quickly, drop anchor, Mayday call. You know, the Mayday call was the most important thing. And thankfully, those patrol officers jumped on it. Because, you know, there's a tendency sometimes to not jump to, you know, like, oh my God, the whole bridge is, you know, like, oh, that's right, too right. big. It's not really going to happen. Let's see what, you know, but they jumped right into action, cut off traffic at both ends of the bridge, you know, and clearly saved lives. So kudos to them for, you know, not thinking about it, not like trying to say, oh, well, you're overreacting. We don't really have to do that. No, they did. They jumped right into action. They cut that traffic off. You know, it reminded me a little bit of the guy, the air traffic controller on 9/11, who, you know, it was way above his pay grade, but he made the call anyway to stop all commercial air traffic, you know, and that was a big ballsy call, right?
Don't think anyone's going to, after the fact, say, hey, you didn't have the
right. Yeah, it was above your pay grade. You shouldn't have done that. Although I know some bureaucrats that might have taken that approach. Yeah. But yeah, in this situation, I'm glad that call went out and they immediately they immediately saw the importance of it. You know, they didn't stop to think about it. They go, okay, we got to cut traffic on the bridge. And they did that. And obviously I think that saved lives.
Unbelievable. And, you know, I want to talk a little bit about this ship. This ship, it's Singapore flagged. It's called the Dali, named after Salvador Dali, the artist. It's 100,000 tons and it's capable of carrying over 10,000 containers. That day it was carrying 4,700. So think of the weight of these things. And to add insult to injury, there are ships, current day ships, that could carry up to 24,000 containers. How crazy is that? Talk about, first of all, I don't know how, if they were in rough seas, they must be dumping containers all over the place, you know?
Yeah, when I ran the LA dive team for the FBI, you know, we worked, our home port was the port of LA, Long Beach. It's actually two different ports, Long Beach and LA, but they're actually adjacent to each other. You really can't tell when you look at it physically. But together, they're the fourth largest port in the world. They're certainly the largest in the United States. And we used to have the super freighters from Singapore and from Asia come over. These super freighters, the ones you're talking about, they're actually too big to fit through the Panama Canal. They can't even go through the canal. They're so big, but they come from Asia over to LA and Long Beach, and they offload, and then they get all those containers go on trains. But I used to marvel. I'd be on my small Boston Whaler boat looking up at these enormous super freighters, they call them. And, you know, I couldn't imagine if one of them went down, the amount of commerce. I heard that some of them have over $1 billion worth of merchandise on them. Over $1 billion worth of merchandise on one ship.
So you're going to let some rebels from Somalia or some Houthis shoot you out?
And, you know, it's like I would look at, you know, in the, you know, if you look at them empty, there's just a flat deck. And then there's this big white kind of tower in the back. That's where they drive it from, right? And that's where all the living quarters are. But sometimes when they're full, the containers are so high, you don't even know how, standing up on that bridge, they can even see the front of the ship, and they don't. They actually have cameras that they're looking at on the bridge because they can't even see all the way to the front of the ship because there's so many containers and the ship is so long and stuff. So they're not like driving a boat where you're looking around and you can see. They're way up here, but they still can't even see because of all the containers and how big and long those boats are.
That's unbelievable. Let me play a little bit of this to get an idea about the how they're trying to remove some of this wreckage.
They have taken some major steps towards reopening the city's port after the Francis Scott Key Bridge collapse. Workers have begun cutting the bridge into pieces, and they've already moved tons of debris in what is now a 24/7 operation. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg spoke about reconstruction of the massive bridge on Face the Nation yesterday.
We haven't received estimates on that yet either. I can tell you the original bridge took about 5 years to build, but that doesn't necessarily inform us about the timeline on the reconstruction. A lot goes into how that reconstruction will be designed, how the process is going to work. Right now, we don't fully know everything we need to know about the condition of the portions of the bridge that did not collapse.
Nicole Skanga is in Baltimore with more.
Steel beams, once vital to the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Maryland, now surgically cut into pieces, part of a complex wreckage removal operation.
It is a mangled, cantilevered mess.
Colonel S.D. Pinchason, Unified Commander of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, says crews will scan an underwater superstructure of concrete and twisted metal after each cut.
They're very careful that they're not going to send divers or equipment in without knowing for sure. They're reducing the risk by not guessing.
The bodies of two construction workers have been recovered. Four other victims are unaccounted for and presumed dead, and Maryland State Police have identified four missing vehicles.
There could be potential spots where there are vehicles and possibly maybe the human remains.
The U.S. Coast Guard is now marking clear sections of the channel, possible passageways for smaller ships. Captain David O'Connell.
I anticipate, you know, smaller draft commercial vessels, maybe some small tugs in the next few days.
Meanwhile, we're learning more about the actions taken by police moments before the collision.
Hold all traffic on the Key Bridge. There's a ship approaching that just lost their steering.
They are heroes. They truly are.
The head of the Maryland Transportation Authority Police Union credits three officers for their quick measures to stop traffic, saving dozens of lives.
When they stopped traffic, there was at least 25 to 30 vehicles stopped behind them each. Had these officers delayed even seconds longer, more people would have died.
As a storm system moves through the area, four anchors attached to the stern of the dolly and a tug are holding that massive container ship down. Officials say that's a precautionary measure to ensure that the ship doesn't spin out, causing further damage. Chanel.
Nicole, thank you. CBS News Baltimore reporter Alexis Davila is
pretty interesting. I mean, you see the, you know, it just is amazing to me. And I understand this whole area is without this bridge. And I think they said over 30,000 cars a day go over this bridge. So it affects the commerce on both sides of the river. But now what they're really concerned with, this is the ninth biggest port in the United States. And, you know, that's the old expression, America's business is business, right?
Yeah.
And, if you can't pay the bills, I don't know if they can have to bring the ships to another port close to this or whatever. But
I would imagine that's going to happen. I would imagine Port Elizabeth in New Jersey is going to see some increase. Philadelphia, south of there, Savannah. So I think that probably the plans are already in the works to divert some of that stuff. Port Elizabeth is a big port. And I'm sure it'll see an increase in traffic. Philadelphia as well. And the other one I can think of is maybe Charleston, Savannah to the south. So I think the other ports will probably wind up picking up some of that traffic, and they'll have to just adjust until that port's accessible again.
I think also there's a lot of pressure with these are very powerful unions, the Longshoremen's Union. I would imagine those guys that work the cranes that pick up these containers, that has to be, and they work pretty damn fast. That has to be an acquired skill over years and years and years. I can't imagine these guys are $50 an hour guys.
That's gotta no, be these aren't the guys from on the waterfront just carrying no. The hook.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, they're with the hook. Yeah,
the hook and the webbing, the you know, the thing they used to throw the boxes in and the crane. That doesn't exist anymore. Those guys from on the waterfront, you know, they're not around anymore. This is a guy that, you know, goes up in that little kind of booth, that air conditioned booth with his little TV or radio, and he's spending all night just lifting those containers, you know, and for 8 hours or 10 hours, whatever their shifts are, he sits in that little booth and he goes back. And I used to watch it because I lived right next to the Port of Long Beach. And it's an amazing way to do it, the way they do that and take them off. It's so mechanical. It's so precise. It was really impressive.
Bobby, don't they have to have tractor trailers at the bottom waiting to pick these things up?
They usually pile them into a pile. It's like separate. Then there's another crane that kind of takes from the pile and either puts it on the train, because there are trains leaving those ports, or onto tractor trailers. You're right. And that's usually an overnight operation to kind of alleviate some of the traffic, so those trucks aren't like in the flow of traffic. But yeah, they empty them onto a lot, and then different cranes kind of take them from the lot and put them on either a train or on those tractor trailers that are lined up by the miles waiting.
Yeah, it's incredible. And we look, as consumers, we're just spoiled. We don't give a shit. We just want our stuff. How's it get there? You know, we don't care. But a lot of this stuff is cars, heavy equipment, steel, all kinds of things that fit into these containers. And then that's what goes out onto the highway. But, you know, the water is probably the fastest and probably most economical way to move stuff.
Right. Right. I mean, look, I worked the mob in the 80s. So, you know, Kennedy Airport was a huge cargo airport. It was even more than passenger traffic. And the mob knew that. And they knew how much money was being moved through the cargo at Kennedy Airport. And it was a huge moneymaker for them. And of course, you'd lose a truck. You'd lose a truck every once in a while. Right. You know, that was your kind of payoff, letting them have one of the trucks and stuff. And, you know, one truck full of, back then, you know, plasma screen TVs or whatever they were, you know, it was worth a lot of money. Just one container was worth a lot of money, and you know, one truck kind of thing. And so, yeah, you're talking about billions, you know, billions, not even millions, but billions of dollars worth of cargo and merchandise.
Unbelievable. Let me just play a little more of this. We get the idea.
A smaller channel on the northeast side of the waterway open to some traffic, including commercial barges and some vessels that will be integral to the salvage operations in the coming days. The U.S. Coast Guard says it's also working on opening up two more channels, one along the south side and a third channel that can accommodate larger ships once more debris surrounding the container ship Dolly is removed. All of this activity happening before President Biden comes to Baltimore on Friday, and the White House announcing today that the Small Business Administration has opened
two business recovery centers in Baltimore for workers, small businesses who were directly impacted by the bridge collapse to visit and to apply for loans of up to $2 million. In the next few days, some concerns that the weather could slow down these salvage efforts. We're expecting a storm system to hit starting tomorrow. Right now, crews have anchored down the container ship dolly, four anchors attached to the stern of the ship and a tug in anticipation of that weather to ensure that the container ship doesn't spin out and cause further damage. Nicole, I'll send it back to you.
Let's bring in senior advisor and assistant to President Biden, Tom Perez. He's also the director.
I don't want to hear from any of these bureaucrats. I think they're still waiting in Palestine. Pennsylvania for Biden to show up.
Right.
It's so ridiculous. I think Baltimore happens to be a blue area, so he's going to go there. You know?
Yeah. So I mean, look, if anybody isn't familiar with ports, and I am very familiar with, especially the Port of Long Beach in LA, they're mini cities. They're like little cities in themselves, and there's a tremendous amount of support that goes into keeping the port going. And as they said in that report, you know, mom and pop sandwich shops and different things exist there. And if the port kind of closes down, even temporarily, you have a lot of business that are impacted. So I'm glad to hear that the Small Business Administration is going to have some relief for a lot of these small businesses that are there just to support the workers, the coffee shops, the sandwich shops and things like that, that, you know, that those that survived COVID are still there and they support the port. And if the port shuts down, they have no customers because this port is like this mini little kind of area, this city unto itself. And so, you know, you're going to have an impact far beyond what people, you know, anticipate.
You know, Bobby, it's funny. You don't even think of that. And that's so true. I mean, I remember even, and you were there too, 9/11 became a little city.
Right.
The security of the site became a huge thing. Criminals were coming into Ground Zero. I don't know if you remember. Some of them were news reporters too.
I remember only because my brother was a patrol sergeant at the time, and he was there the day that the firemen tried to run the line and break through the line. People don't know, the firemen were pretty much forced to go home because they were working till exhaustion and dropping. And right. fire department brass had to say, you have to go home now, because now it's becoming a safety issue. And they wouldn't listen, and some of them showed up. And then there was that one day where, you know, the PD was kind of preventing the firemen from coming on site. And, you know, and my brother was one of the patrol sergeants that was there that day, and it got a little tense. I mean, everything kind of was smooth over, but it was emotions were running high. The security of the site itself, was one of those things. You have support things that are there, that pop up, and a port, like I said, a port has a lot of those small little entities that service all the people that come and go from the port on a daily basis. And when those people aren't coming and going from the port, those businesses have nobody to service, and they're not chains. They're mostly mom and pop operations that have been there for generations, and I hope they get the help that they're going to need.
Yeah, I mean, they thought of that during COVID. It seemed like there was a lot of maybe people that got money during COVID that didn't deserve it, but I'm sure there was a lot of small businesses that were saved by that government rescue plan that they had. I certainly didn't get any money, but you know, Bobby, I wanted to show one thing because I know that you just recently got back from St. Lucia.
Yes.
And you dropped to 208 pounds. So I wanted to show all the women.
Oh, you don't have to do that.
I'll raise my ratings. They love the Bobby.
That's why my hair wasn't so gray.
They love the Bobby Chacon picture in his scuba gear. But
that's my 9/11 tattoo as well. I don't know if you know that. I have the Twin Towers right here and the Pentagon. And I have the NYPD symbol, the FDNY symbol, the PAPD symbol. Wow. All up there. So it's on prominent display in that picture. But St. Lucia was great. It was good to get away, but I hit the ground running coming back because this happened and a couple other cases that I've been kind of covering for the news happened. And I think I finish with you and I go right on to Court TV tonight, covering the 15-year-old autistic boy that's missing in Tennessee. And then tomorrow morning, I'm on News Nation. And I can't remember what I'm covering for News Nation tomorrow morning.
There was another story about two women that were missing.
That's it. That's what I'm covering on News Nation tomorrow. Yeah. The 39-year-old preacher's wife and a 28-year-old woman, they were going to pick up some kids, and they were 16 miles of a 19-mile drive, and then their car is found, and they just vanished. It's one of those cases where they just vanished.
Wow.
It's been a couple of days now that they haven't been heard from. And, you know, so there's high concern about what happened to these two women.
You're certainly one of the busiest talking heads on TV, but well-deserved. I think, you know, it's you do a hell of a job. And, you know, so many of them, and I'm not, well, I don't want to put, but a lot of people are out of their lane. You know what I mean?
Yes.
There's people, there's some talking heads that are just out of their lane. And you know something? If I get pulled on something to talk about, and I don't know about it, I'm not going to talk about it. You know
me
what
too,
I mean?
Me too. And then one of the most popular ones they try to rope me into is profiling. You know, like, oh, what was in the mind of the killer or this and that? And, you know, I wasn't a profiler. And I was a screenwriter on Criminal Minds. I was a tech advisor on Criminal Minds, which is all about profiling. So one of my best friends, Jim Clemente, is a profiler. And that show is partly based on him. You know, it's not that, you know, I always give the profilers their due, because I'll give my opinion, but I'll say my profiler friends tell me this. And because I talk to them literally every day, two particular profilers, Jim Clemente and Jim Fitzgerald. But then I also go, like, look, when I was working murders, either drug gang murders or mafia murders, what was in the mind of the killer? I could care less, because we didn't have to prove that at trial. You know, intent, motive wasn't usually an element of a murder trial. I just had to prove you were the one who did it. Unless it was a hate crime or something like that, motive wasn't it. So it's not that profiling doesn't interest me. It's that I think we've given it too much importance. You've gotten now so many podcasts about the mind of the killer, the mind of the killer. Look, you and I both have talked to killers directly face to face. They're not a very interesting lot. They're morons. They're dirtbags.
You know, I'm glad you're saying this, because so many times, like I even said one time to this one profile who I really like her, and I said, look, your science is just junk science. And I was like, I'm sure she didn't love me after that show, but
I mean, she's great. A lot of people don't know, because of all this stuff. Like, profiling is not allowed in trial. You can't, it's like a polygraph. You can't use it. You can't use a lie detector test in a courtroom. You can't use profiling in a courtroom. And the danger of profiling is, if the profilers come out with 10 criteria that your killer most likely has, and then you ultimately get the killer and he has 8 of those 10, everybody applauds the profiler. But guess what the defense attorney is going to do at trial? He's going to focus on the 2 that his client don't fit, that your profilers told you he would have. And now you're like, oh my God, the profiler said he would have these 2 and he doesn't have those 2. You know, so 80% seems like a good profile, except that trial, you and I both know, we've been through murder trials, that the defense attorney is going to hone in on those 2 elements that they didn't have. And he's going to put those to the jury, and he's going to create a doubt.
Well, it's just like, you know, Brian Koberger in the Idaho case.
Yeah.
They're trying to overanalyze that guy. He's a dirtbag that happened to be going to school for a PhD. He's not that interesting, as you say. And, you know, but so many people want to pretend that, oh my God.
It boggles my mind. You know what? I could care less why he killed those kids. It's not going to bring him back. It's not going to help convict him. I want him convicted and put away for life. You know, if he did it, obviously, and the evidence is there to a jury and they convict him, I want him put away for life. But I don't want him interviewed in jail. Why did you do this? What was in your head? He's a dirtbag killer. Who cares why he did it? It just doesn't matter. It's not going to bring the family any more comfort knowing why he killed their loved one, because the loved one is dead.
Right.
You know, why you think, what could you fathom any possible reason that a family member could hear the reason and go, oh, okay, well, that makes me feel a little better? There isn't any. That's a ludicrous thing. It's, you know, the family. So if the family's not going to get any comfort from it, it's not going to help convict him. Who cares what was in his head?
Absolutely. You know, we sort of got a little bit off topic. So I just wanted to get back on it a little bit. Now, do you see that we need changes in our infrastructure to deal with these super ships? That this one, the Dolly, was almost 1,000 feet long. You know, you're talking three football fields. And there's ships that are bigger than that. So because we have that, there has to be more rules and regs and standards because, as you say, it seems like there was no backup system to create power when it went down. And there was, and it coughed dead. There was black smoke, and I think there was an auxiliary, some kind of power, but it didn't work.
Right, right. And, yeah, I think that's what a hot wash is all about. You know, an after action report about what happened and what steps we could take. Like, I liken it to a couple of years ago, Airbus came out with the A380. It's that super jumbo jet. It's even bigger than the 747. It's a double decker all the way down. You know how the 747 had that hump. It was two floors in the front, but not in the back. This is a plane that's two levels all the way down. And all the airports that wanted to accommodate this plane had to build new terminals and new gates because that plane is too big to get into traditional gates in most airports. So you had to have a retrofitting of all the major international airports. LAX did it. Kennedy did it. Newark did it. And I think sometime the ports have to start thinking about this. When you're bringing these massive freighters, and they seem to be getting bigger all the time, you're going to have to get some type of, you know, outreach. Maybe they moor them somewhere else, or you build a port so that they're outside the bridges, outside the lanes, outside where they can cause that kind of damage, and stuff. And so maybe you think about reconfiguring your ports so that if you have these big ships that can cause so much damage, if something goes wrong, you have them in a different type of place. And you don't have them, you know, going through these types of straits where your bridges, you know, private bridges going over, you know, not private bridges, but private citizens going over these bridges and stuff. So the airports did it for, I know it's not exactly the same, but I know the airports had to go, many airports had to go through a retrofit to fit those bigger planes. And maybe it's time the ports think about something like that as well.
Absolutely. 100%. Let me just go to a quick commercial. Folks, this is Police Off the Cuff, Real Crime Stories. If you like real crime, true crime from a police perspective, then you're in the right place. And if you're not subscribed to us, go on our YouTube, hit that subscribe button, give us a thumbs up, ring that bell, hit the like button, share us with your friends and your family. If you want to contribute to us, we have a Patreon with three different levels. And we also have a YouTube channel membership with Canem, five different levels. And if you haven't just seen, added, we have a new website, Police Off the Cuff 676, which was my shield number.com. I spent a lot of time. In fact, Bobby even did a testimonial on it for me. He wasn't wearing his scuba gear, but he did a testimonial for me, and I appreciate it. I had some really great people give a testimonial on this show. So go check out the website. You know, Bobby, one of the things we think about New York right away, and I thought of two bridges right away, and one of them was the GW, the George Washington Bridge, which I don't know how many thousands of cars go over that a day. And the other one is the Verrazano. And they seem to be two candidates for what could happen if they were hit by a ship this long.
Yeah. And
what are the precautions now that, and you know, how about a terrorist taking over a large ship and doing this on purpose,
right?
Forcing the crew to do this.
Well, I mean, you're right. Look, I mean, 9/11 was a failure of imagination. A lot of people talk about, and that is like, oh, we never envisioned somebody taking over a jetliner and flying into a building. But you're right; they could easily take over, you know, a ship like that, and actually, you know, speed it up and aim for that bridge. And can you imagine? I mean, you know, who's going to stop that? What's going to stop that? The Coast Guard doesn't have any ship that can interdict something like that quickly and stop it when it has a head of steam going. I think of the Verrazano even more than the GW because the Verrazano is out there, you know, closer to the open ocean and stuff. Right. And that's a high bridge. I've been over many times. I think they're trying to always increase the toll to keep people off that bridge because it's so expensive to go over now. I remember the days where you paid it going both ways. And then they stopped that, and then you only paid it going one way, but, you know, they doubled it, of course, on the other side. But, yeah, that's the one that I would think of even more than the GW vulnerable because you can come right at it from the open ocean. Yeah, you're right. I mean, that vulnerability is there. And as we know, after 9/11, I mean, these terrorists can employ engineers that can tell them exactly the vulnerabilities of a particular structure and how to attack it in a way that could maximize the damage.
You know, it seems like a way to protect some of these bridges is to have by the pillars a ground, like actually so that the ship can't reach it because there's ground around the pillar. And I mean, that could be like a new 21st century design, but many of these bridges are so old in their design that they don't take into consideration the huge ships that we have on the waters today, these huge container ships. And that's a problem. That's a real problem.
Yeah. I would be interested to know like the newer bridges, like if they have them, they're obviously constructed differently and stuff. I know like out here in California, they're always doing things with earthquakes. They've made buildings, you know, some of the older buildings out here have been grandfathered in, but every time we have an earthquake, you know, they build these, you know, these different things now, or not earthquake proof, but, you know, earthquake resistant type of things into some of the larger buildings and stuff. And I think that, you know, you're right. I think that that's what they have to start thinking about that. But where we're vulnerable is these older bridges, our infrastructure. Whenever you hear people talk about the infrastructure, the problem is it is aging, and it is, we have many, many, many old bridges that were built long before any of these were even considerations.
Absolutely. Mr. Electric from the chat, as a retired engineer, this is a mess. Yeah, I agree with you.
And I'm not an engineer, but coming from an engineer, that says a lot. You know, when an engineer, because engineers are figure, you know, they're problem solvers, you know, they figure things out. And if an engineer is telling you it's a mess with a capital M.
Simi Sharp, I like your channel, Bill. I only found you recently, but I'm enjoying myself here. Thank you. Well, I think it's because I have great guests like Bobby Chacon on. And
you do a great job.
Well, thank you. Mr. Electric, Bill, after what happened to us at the Skyway, it's just so sad they knew this could happen. You know, I just think that, you know, and I don't want to get political, but we seem to be spending so much money on things that don't benefit this country. And here you have these structures that really need to be looked at and maybe upgraded, you know, and maybe in Baltimore, maybe they shouldn't build another bridge. Maybe they should build a tunnel. Probably cost more money and would take longer, but are bridges getting antiquated with some of this stuff? I don't know.
I mean, if you Googled aging infrastructure, I mean, that term has been around for so long. It's still there. It's still, you know, I don't know what it's going to take for politicians to look at, you know, our electrical grid, you know, our bridges and tunnels and things like that. But, you know, as long as I can remember, politicians have been talking about the aging infrastructure, what they're going to do about it, but there never seems to be, you know, enough done.
No, there never seems to be money to fix those things that are so important. And it brings it to the forefront when a tragedy like this happens, and all of a sudden you think, oh, the Verrazano, the GW, and then I'm sure every city across this nation has a bridge that they feel is threatened by something like this, especially the huge ports, like you say, the Port of Los Angeles, the Port of New York, the Port of Miami. All of these places, I'm sure, have the same vulnerabilities that they haven't looked at, and that's a problem.
Well, you know, we go from crisis to crisis to crisis, right? It's not a crisis until, you know, a tragedy happens, right? And stuff. So you can talk about the aging infrastructure, but unless it's like, you know, unless it's front page news, it doesn't get the attention from Congress or the politicians that it should be getting, because it's not a juicy soundbite for them on the 6 o'clock news. You know, building the infrastructure, you know, is slow, boring, behind the scenes stuff, but it's important. And it shouldn't only be talked about when there's a tragedy.
You know, 100%. I mean, even you get back to the World Trade Center, they built the Freedom Tower a lot differently than they would have built the World Trade Center, or the way the World Trade Center was built, I believe, in the 1970s, I think that was built, right?
Yeah, 70s.
So now they built these a lot differently. And one good design thing about the World Trade Center was it was designed in the event of a tragedy like what happened to drop straight down instead of fall. Had that fallen over, that would have been
right. It was an engineering marvel. And hopefully now with new bridges in these days that the engineering Can take some of this into account. I mean, I think you're right. I think, you know, the land around the stanchions or, you know, some things have to be start to be thought about as that. And it's not only for potential terrorists. This was clearly an accident, but accidents happen. And, you know, shame on us if we don't anticipate those type of accidents and build in safeguards for the public safety.
That's 100%. Folks, if you're looking for a great attorney in the New York metropolitan area, then Joe Murray is your man. Joe's a retired NYPD police officer and now a fantastic defense attorney. You can reach him at 718-514-3855, email him at joe@jmurray-law.com, or go on his website, jmurray-law.com. Not only is Joe a fantastic attorney, but a huge supporter of the Police Off the Cuff podcast. You know, Bobby, I know you got other shows to go on tonight. I just want to thank you. I mean, I call you with like one day's notice. I'll make it. And I really appreciate that. You look fantastic. You look buff, you know.
Thank you.
You know, I've been trying to, like, as you get older, you do less weights because your joints can't take it anymore. And I do more cardio.
Yeah.
I try to do like 45 minutes a day, every day.
And I turned 60 last year and I said, you know, I better start getting myself back into shape. So.
Well, that's good. You look fantastic, and I hope you had a great vacation. Your final thoughts on this matter, Bobby?
Like I said, people have to be patient. It's going to take a long time to recover all that stuff on the bottom. The divers have to go slow, work with the engineers, and then rebuilding is going to be another whole separate process. And hopefully some of the things you and I spoke about tonight will be taken into consideration on any new bridge that they build. But right now, In the near future, my thoughts are on those divers and those engineers and those crane operators and those steel workers that are doing the cutting and the removal of the bridge that's in the water. And, you know, I pray and I hope that, you know, nobody gets hurt in that process.
I can't even imagine doing those type of jobs. You know, just, you know, like we mentioned, steel workers, your scuba guys that go below the surface and cut underwater, like how much would they have to pay you to do that? I mean,
yeah. I actually do that. I did that. I have my underwater cutting and welding license. I was a commercial diver. And so it was actually fun to cut things up. Welding wasn't as much fun because welding has to be done right. When you're cutting, you're a little freer to kind of just, you know, freestyle it a little bit. But the welding part was always precise and had to be done just right. Those welds are important and stuff. But yeah, my thoughts are with the divers and the engineers and the crane operators and everybody else that's working in those dangerous situations until they get all of that debris off the bottom so that they can clear the way for whatever that comes next.
Absolutely. Anyway, folks, thank you for tuning in tonight. That's our show. Bobby Chacon, thank you so much for coming on. Everyone have a great night and God bless.
Thanks, boss.
One episode, just ain't enough.